Hello, friends. This is the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. The goal of the AlphaList podcast is to empower CTOs with the info and insight they need to make the best decisions for their company. We do this by hosting top thought leaders and picking their brains for insights into technical leadership and tech trends. If you believe in the power of accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Plus, if you're an experienced CTO, you will love the discussion happening in our Slack space where over 600 CTOs are sharing insights, or visit one of our events. Just go to alphaList.com to apply. Tired of sifting through countless resumes and struggling to find the right tech talent? Look no further. WorkGenius has some exciting news to share with you. WorkGenius has acquired ExpertLead. Now, they bring even more efficiency to your hiring process. Real-time live coding assessments for all. Whether you're a startup or an established enterprise, WorkGenius is now also here to turbocharge your hiring process. Say goodbye to the guesswork and endless interviews. WorkGenius matches your candidates with experts, saving you time and getting you top talent. Win-win. How it works? Share your tech job applicants, WorkGenius takes care of the rest. Your candidates? They are in the hands of seasoned pros. WorkGenius matches them with experienced senior developers and puts them through tailored, enjoyable, and fair technical interviews. Your company gets the cream of the crop, the most sought-after talents in the industry, and you save your hardworking tech and HR teams valuable time. If you want to try it out, visit link.alphalist.com/work. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I'm your host, Toby, and today with me is Andy Walker. And Andy is, like, quoting his LinkedIn profile, a fractional human right now. So he was working for Google and Skyscanner in, like, high-level managerial positions, and is now spending lots of time with his daughter and teaching robotics in school, is an author, a speaker. So did I introduce you correctly, Andy?
Yeah, that's a pretty good start. I'll settle for that.
So what do you do each day right now?
I think I haven't really got a set schedule, to be honest. A lot of my life is obviously around school drop-offs and childcare, and I'm in the luxurious position to be able to choose to prioritize that, which is an absolute privilege. My little girl's nearly 6 years old. And then around that, it's whatever takes my fancy. So I'm still in the process of trying to write up all the things I learned in 30 years of making lots and lots of mistakes, both as an engineer and hopefully as some kind of manager, and occasionally do the odd bit of coaching or consulting if people I've worked with before want to bounce ideas off. So yeah, it's quite a happy place.
A happy place. And today, well, so partly talking about kids, but we want to talk about your idea on autonomy and how autonomy should be lived. I mean, you went through quite a learning journey, I think, in quite big companies, many companies try the autonomy game and many fail. What are your thoughts on autonomy and how it should be these days?
So I think autonomy's important, but the term autonomy frequently gets misused around. People perceive it as, don't tell me what to do. And the reality is nobody ever lives in a world of full autonomy. And we've taken it almost as an ideological point that people should be given freedom to do what they want. But we never have the adult conversation about how much autonomy people should have. And obviously, at one end of the scale, there is colossal micromanagement, which is not how you get the best out of people, by taking all their choices away. And at the other end of the scale is do whatever you want, which results in chaos. And so if you want to have meaningful autonomy, you kind of need to get to the point of saying, what level of autonomy should people have in what situation? And it's actually quite funny, because a lot of the roots we have with autonomy come from growing up And being a parent now, I get to apply those skills across the other side with my little girl. And I was thinking about this after reading the question, and it's like choosing what to watch on television. So when your child learns to use the TV remote, which is a happy and terrifying day at the same time, there are a bunch of decisions they can make. So, for example, which episode of Octonauts should you watch is a decision which I would expect my daughter to have full autonomy over. Should she choose between watching Octonauts and Paw Patrol? Again, this is not a decision I should have any part of. Should she watch Aliens? Absolutely not, because I want her to sleep at some point in the next 10 years. Should she choose to watch TV all day? No, because there are better things in life than just watching television, although it's also quite nice to just sit in front of the TV and have some downtime. Should she watch Star Wars? Well, obviously my answer to that is yes, but she has no intention of ever watching it. So this is a situation where the decision I would take for her is one she wouldn't take herself, and she should still have agency over that. And at this point in her life, this is roughly the kind of scope of her world in terms of watching television. But as she grows up, she will take more and more autonomy of that situation as she learns to make better choices, and to the point where eventually I'll have no say over what she watches at all, which is inevitably what happens when your child outgrows your influence as a parent. And when we're talking about autonomy within companies, you should understand that you're trying to give the people the most autonomy they can handle at a given point in time, and that's going to change. So, for example, you come into a new job as a software engineer, and on day one, it's, we need you to develop this payment system, which is going to work across 160 countries and is going to solve all of these criteria. That's not something you should give a new graduate full autonomy over, because the outcome of that is likely to be quite bad. And so what you're looking at saying is, how much autonomy can you handle right now? And how do we put you in a situation where the bits where you don't have autonomy over, you're learning from, so that your ability to tackle larger and more difficult things grows over time? And what tends to not happen with autonomy is we don't have that conversation. So when somebody feels that they don't have appropriate decision-making power, they turn around and say, you're not giving me autonomy, like it's necessarily a bad thing, rather than the better conversation of, what level of autonomy should you have at this point in time, and how can we help you grow that level of autonomy?
And you think it's like an individual thing that you define per person, or is it rather like you define as a company, hey, this is my, as Netflix does it, this is my paved road, and you can follow that. You could also decide to not follow it, and then like if you mess it up, you're fired. That's, I think, how Netflix handles that. Or is it like, how would you approach it?
So you need to approach it at both the individual and collective level, and almost a hierarchy of collective levels as well. So within a particular team, so say you're in a 10-person team, you have a certain amount of freedom to act within the confines of that team. That team has a certain amount of freedom to act within the confines of the organization it's in. The organization it's in has a certain freedom to act within the confines of the company they're in. You know, the company has a set of freedoms to act based upon what isn't legal. And at each point in that hierarchy, from the individual up to the like fully collective company, there are differing degrees of freedom allowed. And it's quite natural to push at some of those degrees of freedom, because you want the tension to be coming both ways. Not just you have the scope to act, but if you feel you should have greater scope, we should have a conversation about it, so that we can either say yes, but with this support required, or actually maybe that's not the greatest idea right now. And a lot of the times where you have conversation about autonomy, particularly when you're doing the difficult thing as a leader, to say, actually, you, whilst there's autonomy within this problem space, you cannot do that right now, and here are the reasons why. And when you are pushing it and you get additional scope and autonomy, it should again be a conscious conversation of, these are the decisions you have the ability to affect, and we're growing them to give you this, these additional responsibilities. This is why we believe it's appropriate at this time, and this is the support which we're going to provide from you, and what support do you need from us to be able to take this on? And with autonomy, that conversation is the thing which doesn't happen. And if you're looking at it within a company, then the hardest thing as you grow beyond a particular size is autonomy without alignment is chaos. And so the alignment piece around what problems are we trying to solve? How do we know what success looks like? Who do we need to work with in order to solve these problems? Becomes a more important conversation to have over the period of time. Mm-hmm. And again, you leave university and you're not really used to working in a group of people. You might have done some group exercises, but they're going to be quite limited. You start your first job, particularly if you're working in a non-trivially sized company, and you're working in a team, but that team's working in a bigger piece. And you've never been trained in the skills to, how do I actually define what a good outcome for something is? Because you're given assignments and the outcomes provided for you and the problems provided for you. And so when somebody starts in a company, it's, okay, let's work together to solve this problem. As you progress through that company, the conversation becomes, should we solve this problem? And then when you progress further still, the problem turns into, which problems should we be solving? And it's very easy to take that initial thing of like sort of the day-to-day individual contributor where you know what problem you're solving and it's very clear what the next step is to the next level, which is how do I start making sure the problems we're working with are aligned with other people, to the next level, which is of the problems we've been given, should we be working on them? And then finally, the step of, right, what are we actually trying to achieve as a company here? Mm-hmm. And each step in that journey is non-intuitive when you arrive at it for the first time, but you don't know that you'd have that gap in your processing because you've never experienced it before.
And how do you think this can work in an effective way? Let's say we have a very large organization with smaller teams where like the team has like full autonomy on a certain piece of technology, on maybe a product. And you then have other teams like in the company, in a big matrix, you have, I don't know, marketing, you have people that maybe even take care of security, etc. What is from your perspective, like the ideal setup for this to perform? For you to actually align with other people, for teams to actually align with others, what's the setup you would take these days?
I think it's an education thing. You've got to be teaching your people, particularly in leadership positions, that their set of responsibilities includes ensuring that the people in their teams are aligned with what the team's trying to do, that team is aligned with what the teams around them are trying to do, and that problem is aligned with the user problem you're trying to solve. And if any of those alignments are missing, then you're going to have a really bad time. And what tends to happen is we don't have those upfront conversations where we look at where the synergies might appear and how we can support each other and what we need from each other. And then at the end of the quarter, when everyone's panicking over their quarterly objectives, and I know you hate the word OKRs, then that's when those alignment conversations happen, because suddenly people need things from each other, or they discover that what they're doing is mutually exclusive with what another team is doing. And when you're pushing those conversations too late, they tend to happen at metaphorical gunpoint. And that's when you wind up with a lot of politics within your organization and a lot of bad feeling as a result of it. And so teaching people to have these conversations, making sure that the people in leadership positions have the skills to actually mediate those discussions and to do it in a way which is healthy and constructive and doesn't lead to residual poison within your organizations. Those are the key things. And if you don't have those skills, it doesn't matter what framework you use. Ultimately, if you look at any kind of project management or software engineering methodology, the framework itself is interesting from an intellectual perspective, but it's the people skills around actually implementing it, applying common sense, understanding why you're doing what you're doing, and doing it at scale with other human beings who may be motivated in a different way to you. Those are the things which determine whether you're going to be successful or not.
Absolutely makes sense. Is I mean, it's from my perspective, it makes sense to at least know those instruments, right? To know the Spotify model and understand like what do I apply and how is still like the understanding, hey, I'm working with other human beings that maybe have other interests, is maybe like the first step, right?
I think this is where people in leadership positions can also bridge the gap, because if you're not going out and understanding what the teams in your organization and other organizations are doing, you can't act as the introductions agency to make sure that people who should be talking to each other are talking to each other. And it's a kind of that connective tissue, which doesn't happen organically in most cases, although you can start teaching your people to form those connections without you being the instigator of them. But in a management leadership position, you're the catalyst for it happening. And if it's not happening, if people don't, you know, a simple 3-question smell test, which my old team would roll their eyes at this point if they're hearing it, is what problem are you working on? Or what problems do you need to solve here? How do we know they're important? Then how do you know you're making progress or have succeeded in those problems? So you know, this is where if you can't actually measure what success looks like, then you're just doing things. And that's the chaos form of autonomy. And then the final one, which is very frequently overlooked, is who do you need to work with to get this done? And this might be who do you need something from? It might be who are going to be making requests from you. So if you're in a team where you're getting a lot of inbound traffic from other teams, so if you're an infrastructure team, you have your own roadmap, but you've got to balance it with the fact that there are people who are dependent on you to deliver their roadmaps. So if you're not making those connections, you're going to have an even worse time because you've got a lot of inbound traffic. And so if a teams can't answer those questions, then they're never going to play nicely together in a team environment. Mm. And it's really just a smell test to say, is this even something that we're able to do?
Makes sense. Still, as a company, I mean, you depend a lot on your leaders and that you trust your leaders, right? That's also okay. If you have that setup where like each of the team really believes in autonomy and being like an autonomous team, then sometimes they're like, especially the leaders are also hesitating to accept help from others, right? From other teams. Let's say you have your own marketing person in your team and still you want that marketing person to collaborate with that marketing team, then a good idea could also to introduce something like dotted lines, so that it's like kind of given in the organizational design and in the org chart, that you get in other sparring partners. How do you see that? Like, does it make sense or?
It can make sense from a perspective of formalizing that you should be talking to this person. But obviously, the more people you answer to, the harder it is to get anything done. And so the reality is the more interesting discussion is who should be the decision maker in this? Who's ultimately accountable for making this decision within the company? Mm. And you know, one of my rules of thumb as whether I'm functioning as a leader was how many decisions do I have to make? And my goal is to never have to make a single decision, which is obviously a futile goal because that's never going to happen. But it makes me think about how do I push the decision to the lowest part of the hierarchy as possible so that the people closest to the work are able to have agency over what they're doing. Mm. And this should be business as usual. And in fact, if you're working on something and you're responsible for getting it done, you should have decision-making power over 99% of the things in front of you. The interesting case is the edge case for that 1% where what you're working on may be mutually exclusive to another team. So having the conversation early and saying there is a misalignment here means we can now say, well, what is the misalignment? What decision do we need to have made here? Mm-hmm. And how should that decision be made? And obviously the first choice is the people should get in a room and talk about it and then come to a decision together. And then your job as a leader, firstly, is to make sure they get in the room and have that discussion. And then if they need to escalate it further, that they know who they should escalate it to. And then when they escalate the decision, they escalate together with the agreement on how the decision is going to be made and that they'll commit to the decision after the event.
That's very clear. I just think that this example that I brought with the marketing person, let's say you're a technical leader, you have a marketing person in your team, then it will be hard to like stand or like accept that maybe in those marketing cases you're not the ideal person to decide, but you maybe rather ask the marketing team in many cases, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that when you have multidisciplinary teams, you've got to, the people from different disciplines are kind of the representatives of their discipline looking at the bigger picture. And they may, for example, if you have a UX designer and a data scientist and a back-end engineer and a front-end engineer and a mobile applications engineer, they're all going to have a different idea about what should happen. And that's a healthy thing. Then within the team, there should be the default decision-making process, which is if you're working on it, you get to decide. If you're working on it and it affects other people, then you need to get their buy-in to do it. And if you don't have their buy-in, then who should make the decision about whether or not you should do the thing? Mm-hmm. And then within the team, you kind of look at the product manager role as, and a lot of the cases should be to curate, these are the problems we should be working on, and to have a fairly large say in the prioritization of those problems.
Mm.
But at the same time, if you look at a product manager, they're going to be looking at what the features we're going to be developing. If you're looking at the tech lead, they're going to be looking at how much tech debt are we accruing in developing these features. And therefore, what amount of our time should we be devoting to actually keeping on top of it so that we don't stall our progress over time? I think there's a naturally healthy tension in there. And every time you add a new discipline into that within the team, you add an additional tension. And so if your team becomes wildly disciplinary, that there is no one-size-fits-all solution. Mm-hmm. You have to get people to talk about how they're working together and agree how to do things. And then provide healthy mechanisms for resolving disagreement if it exists.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is, when one of the warning signs, when people come and say they want to be a manager and you ask them, why do you want to be a manager? And a lot of the time they say, it's because I want the authority to make decisions, which is a proxy for, I want to tell people what to do. And the reality is even though technically you have decision-making power with seniority, the more you use it, the less effective it becomes. So every time you make a decision that could have been made by the people closest to the work or which people feel is imposed upon them, they stop thinking for themselves. They lose their intrinsic connection with what they're doing because it's not their thing anymore. It's them doing the thing you want them to do. And this is why micromanagement is such a terrible thing. And it's almost as you become a leader and the more senior you get, the more you have to take a step back from decisions, because otherwise you become the bottleneck for everything happening and nobody really is invested in what's happening because all paths lead to you. And you see that with a lot of scale-up companies where the CEO has been a really high contributing individual contributor. And as the company grows past a certain size, that's the way they solve problems. But it means that inevitably, because they're involved in everything that's happening, everything that's happening goes to them. And at a certain point, there's not enough hours in the day anymore. And they're far enough divorced from the detail of all of the work that all of their teams are doing. They simply cannot continue to function that way.
Mm. But that's ideally a realization you have before you're CEO of a company, right? And that leaders learn throughout the way?
I think typically you have that realization after you've experienced the hard lessons for it. People can tell you that it's coming, but until you've lived through it, it's very hard to give those warnings any particular kind of credibility. And it's the same when you become a manager. So you become a manager and hopefully your manager sits down with you and tells you that, welcome to your new career, a career for which you've had no formal training. And have no academic basis for understanding what makes a good manager or a bad manager, just a set of experiences which you've had up to this point. And we're not going to tell you what the best use of your time is. And in fact, that's going to be different for every new manager starting. We're not necessarily going to tell you what skills you need to develop to be effective in your role, but you don't have them and you won't know that you don't have them until you run into a problem. Yeah, and it's the same thing at any point in the chain. So even becoming a manager of a small team is a completely different job to being a tech lead within that team. Being a manager of managers is a completely different problem from being a manager of a small team. Running an entire organization is another step up from that. And running a company is the same thing again. And ultimately, if we don't embrace the fact that we're stupid at every point in this journey, we're setting ourselves up to failure, but we're not just setting ourselves up to failure because we have people we're responsible for. We're setting them up for failure as well.
Yeah. And in Germany, there's a saying, der Fisch stinkt vom Kopf, the fish stinks from the head. And that's true in so many cases. Navigating through the crowded space of corporate podcasts, I've come across a standout. The Code-Centric Culture and Career Podcast. However, it's important to note that this podcast is primarily in German. What distinguishes this podcast from the sea of similar content? It's a refreshing departure from the typical corporate narrative. At Code-Centric, they've embraced a unique approach. The podcast gives a platform to their employees, allowing them to voice their experience and perspectives. This includes everything from the ups and downs of project business, grappling with imposter syndrome, to the complexities and rewards of balancing parental leave with a career in consulting. What I find most commendable about Code-Centric's approach is their unwavering dedication to authenticity. This podcast isn't about putting on a performance or overwhelming listeners with advertisement. It's an open window into their culture, candidly showcasing their strengths and acknowledging areas of improvement. For those who seek authentic stories and insights into the professional world, the Code-Centric's Culture and Career Podcast is more than just a recommendation. It's an essential listen. I encourage you to dedicate an hour to it. The experience is truly worthwhile. To tune in, simply use Spotify or your preferred podcast platform and search for it, or visit link.alphalist.com/cc.
So, absolutely. And one of the things I did at Skyscanner, which I took a lot of pleasure out of, although probably didn't end the way I wanted to, was look at what does it take for a team to be effective? And often what we do is we look at the outputs of a team and we try and measure where their status is to say, is this team being effective? But we don't stop to go and ask the earlier question of, are the conditions in place where this is going to be a high-performing team? And I became fascinated with how I could start trying to debug that before the thing turned into a dumpster fire. Mm. And the more I looked through it, the more I realized that everything was my fault for the teams that I was responsible for. And I'd come out of looking at the team and saying, well, you're not aligned with other teams, but that's on me to make sure you're talking to the right people, introducing you to the right people and supporting you through things. It's not clear what problems you're working on. You don't have necessarily the skills required to deliver what you're doing. So you've got a team which is doing a lot of front-end work, but they don't have any UX designers. So what happens is, well, people start doing UX design because it needs to happen. But the difference between a software engineer coming up with a design for a screen and somebody who actually is competent at it is enormous. Mm. Okay, so obviously you're going to have a problem there. And you look at, well, look at the priorities of the team. So there's a thing called Eisenhower's matrix for urgent and important on the two axes. And like, just plot everything you're doing in there. And if everything's in urgent and important, I guarantee your life is one daily firefighting hell and you never get to work on the long-term things which actually make a difference. And when I started going through that, the people who were getting to-do lists from that were not the people in the teams. In some cases, weren't even the managers of those teams, but the people higher up in the organizations which need to provide that environment for teams to be successful.
And how are people motivated from your perspective? Maybe to form it a bit broader.
The thing I always come back to, there's an amazing video on YouTube by Dan Pink about motivation. So search for YouTube, Dan Pink, RSA. And it talks about, it's from his book Drive. And he said, yeah, there are three things you need to be in place for people to be intrinsically motivated. That's it. They come in to work with a purpose. They take the initiative. They get things done. They really high performing. And those three things are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So we're going back to our old friend autonomy here, is they need to feel in control over what they're doing. They need to feel that they have a say and that they have a voice in what they're doing. They need to feel ownership of it. They need to believe that what they're doing is the right thing to do. And again, if you're delegating decisions to the lowest point in the hierarchy, you're increasing the possibility that people are going to believe in what they're doing. If you're able to communicate the vision of what you're trying to achieve with clarity and it resonates with people, they're going to feel that what they're doing is the right thing and is just. So, for example, if you were working at a social media company and your boss told you that your job was to sell the contact details of everybody in the company, you're not going to have a strong sense of purpose there, because I'm relatively certain it's going to clash with your internal moral compass. Whereas if you're trying to do something like, well, we want to make it as easy as possible for people to find what they're looking for, that, yeah, Google's original purpose of organize all of the world's information and make it universally accessible, that was a vision that people could see, look at and say, I want to be part of that. Now, if their vision had been, we want to get all of the users in the world and lock them into our platform and sell advertising to them, that's not going to resonate in the same way. But if you're in an ads team, then you can tie it in to say, well, in order to pay for all the infrastructure to do all of this stuff, we need to actually make some money to fund all of this, unless people are willing to pay a subscription. But we should do it in line with those principles. And so if you look at sort of the original AdSense, where for whole classes of query, the paid for search results were better than the actual search results. So yeah, if I type BMW into my web browser right now, then I'm going to get a whole bunch of things from the BMW main site. But I'm also going to get a whole bunch of adverts for BMW dealerships nearby, because that might be a search which leads me to buy a car. And so depending on what my intent is for those two queries, if I'm interested in learning about a BMW, then the organic results might be very useful. If I'm interested in actually spending money on a BMW, then the paid for results are going to be useful. And one of the reasons Google was wildly successful was they managed to tie even the less altruistic things into that central purpose. And then the final thing is mastery, which is growth, which is the ability to learn new skills and also become more proficient in the skills that we have. And if you look at each person within the team and you say, do they own what they're doing? Do they have the right level of autonomy with what they're saying? And it's not a yes, no question. It's a very sliding scale for autonomy based upon the person, where they're at in their career and their relationship with the team. Do they believe in what they're doing? Do they think what they're doing is making a positive difference? And are they actually going to grow individually and in their career by doing what they're doing? And if the answer is no to any of those questions, that's something you should probably look into and do something about. And it's kind of, if you don't have that intrinsic motivation, people aren't going to be as effective. And my rough rule of thumb here is you're going to have, there is such a thing as a 10X person within your team that is seems to operate on a completely different level. With those people, give them as much agency as possible, because they're the template you want everybody else to follow. For people who believe in what they're doing, have got the ability to grow, they're going to be about three times as effective as people who don't have the necessary requirements for intrinsic motivation. And for the people who none of those things are true for, they're actually going to be a drain on the team, because they have no benefit coming out of it. They don't feel that they own what they're doing. They aren't growing from doing what they're doing, and they don't believe in what they're doing. Those are the people who'll drag their feet. They'll challenge everything. If the only way to get them to do things is to tell them what to do or let them go off on a random crusade. And if you tell somebody to do something and they don't believe in it and they don't feel they have agency, They'll drag their feet like a sulky teenager, and they won't actually take any initiative or get things done. They will do the bare minimum to do what you've told them to do.
And what's the ideal team size so that those people can really drag the team along? What do you think? Like, what happens when a team grows past Dunbar? How can you maintain effectiveness and the right autonomy level?
Okay, so even before you hit Dunbar, then any team over about 10 people, they're going to be enough people in the team that they're going to struggle to effectively communicate, because every new person adds a new relationship between those people. So if you've got 3 people in the team, you've got 3 relationships in the team. If you've got 4 people in the team, that goes up to 6 relationships. And by the time you get to 10, you're pushing nearly 100. So if you're not, if you grow past a particular size for like a unit of work, then that's going to have a problem anyway. And in fact, like the ideal sort of sub-team size is kind of 3 to 5 people, I would say, maybe 2, but try and avoid ones, because people working alone in a vacuum tend to get lost quite easily, and it's motivating bouncing ideas off another person. Too many people, and it's just going to be a whole life of people missing out on things. And so you kind of organize a team because that's a level of information sharing you need, even if they have several major sub-problems they're associated with. When you get past Dunbar's number, then human beings can't maintain that number of relationships individually. And that's bearing in mind they're also going to have individual relationships outside of work as well that they're hoping to maintain. And so that's where all of your communication, which worked where everybody knew what everybody else was doing, just stops working. And it's not a gradual thing. It's just one day you suddenly find people, the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing all over the place. And you ask yourself how this happened, because there were no early warning signs to tell you that this was going to happen. And then you have to unpick the damage that's caused, because people have headed off in misaligned directions. And the further they go in that direction, the more they're going to resist being aligned towards a common direction afterwards. So I think it's breaking. Anytime you get past Dunbar's number, it's how do you subdivide it into smaller pieces? And where the smallest unit is kind of the team, which is anywhere between sort of 5 to 10 people, then sub-organization on top of that might be 40 to 50 people. But again, it really depends on the problems you're working on. Some problems can be divided down quite easily that way. Some problems might need a larger team. Some problems might need a smaller team. And another danger here is thinking that there's a one-size-fits-all solution, and sort of hiring people to fit your one-size-fits-all solution. So it's like a football team where you bring players in to fit your system, impose your system on the players, or play the best system you can with the players that you do have. And of those, the most desirable is do the best you can with the people you do have, because they're all going to have wildly different capabilities. Despite what the industry keeps trying to tell us, human beings, particularly engineers, are not fungible in any way, shape or form. And we should stop trying to treat them as numbers on a resource sheet and start treating them as individuals. And better than that is that you hire the people to fit into the system you want to play. And the worst one is you have a rigid system and you try and fit people into it irrespective of their actual capabilities. I've seen horrifying things like all teams should be 6 people in size. And of those 6 people, you want 2 at entry level, 2 at the next level up, and 2 at senior level, because that's how we're going to support career development. And then I've been to meetings where people have pulled up metrics on this and started trying to manage the company based upon adhering to those metrics. Those are the meetings which make me die a little inside as a human being.
How dead are you inside these days?
After 30 years in the industry, pretty dead. I have a flicker of life somewhere, but it seems that over the course of my working career, there have been incredible strides taken in terms of understanding what healthy teams look like and what high-performing teams look like, you know, both in business and in sport. That some of the writing which is out there these days is just astonishing. You open books and it's like a bomb going off in your head. It's like, how did I not notice this before? This is so obvious. And yet, despite all of this material being out there, we don't seem to be doing a lot better than we were doing about 30 years ago. And in fact, in some cases, we appear to be going backwards.
Very good conversation, and lots of meat to the bone already. I still wanted to do like a little rapid fire round with you, and really like give you very short time to answer a question. Still have very meaty questions. So very short. One word to describe your management style.
I'd hope that it's nurturing. But I imagine depending upon which state you catch me in, people might find it to be that or quite impatient. But I'm also aware of the demons I have within inside myself. So, yeah, I'd like the word to be nurturing.
Okay, that was way more than one word, but... best book on team autonomy? I think you already answered it, right?
I'd say Turn the Ship Around is the best book.
Turn the Ship Around. Okay.
Every time I recruited or promoted someone to a management position, I bought them a copy of that book and told them to read it.
One common mistake leaders make with autonomy?
Giving too much of it.
Okay.
And being afraid to step in lest somebody turns around and set them and says, you're taking my autonomy away.
Most overrated metric?
In what sense? I'm going to go with daily active users. And I'm going to go with that because of Facebook. And it's a metric which becomes horribly gamed and leads to really bad outcomes if you're trying to build software based upon that. I can expand on it. I probably should. So daily active users is basically saying, It's a proxy for saying how engaging is my product, as in how often do I want people to, or are people coming back to it, which as a proxy for how valuable do they find it can be very useful if it is applied with common sense. But when you run into Goodhart's law of when a metric becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure, then you wind up with the situation of, well, if this is the thing which we're judging success by, then my success is measured by how often I can get people to look at my part of the system. So I'm going to do everything possible to get people to look at my part of the system, which is why you do horrible things like send millions of notifications to people. Or when they switch off all notifications to your product, you release a new version, which sneakily turns the notifications back on. And when you start looking at how do I manipulate my users to look at my product more rather than how do I satisfy my users' needs with your product, you're solving the wrong problem.
Perfect follow-up question. Is work-life balance a myth?
No. I think that you always have a choice who you're working for, and you have to choose what the most important uses of your time. And in fact, if you want a really powerful coaching conversation with somebody, ask them, what are the three most important things to you in your life? And then ask them, what are the three things you spend the most time on? And if the answers to those questions aren't the same, you've got somebody who's going to get lost pretty quickly. And at a point in your life, it may be that work is the single most important thing to you in your life. Yeah, so when I just graduated, I worked very, very long hours because I was excited about starting this new thing. When I became a parent, that was not true anymore by a long stretch. And in between, I had varying degrees of realization about necessity for having other things in your life. So I think it's important to keep the boundaries so that you're excited about the things you're doing. And so you're doing the things which are important to you. And there's no right or wrong work balance. It depends on a person by person basis.
So
work-life balances are obviously unhealthy and people should take a long, hard look at themselves.
So for you, that realization came really with having kids or having a kid?
I think it came beforehand, to be honest. I think it came about 10 years before having kids. I looked at what I was doing and I asked myself the question of, do I want to be doing this in 20 years' time? Or will I even be able to do this with the same intensity I am in 20 years' time? And this letter, there's a conversation I had with an Australian guy in the Himalayas who was originally an Olympic cross-country skier and he'd cross-trained to be a doctor. And he cross-trained in his sort of mid to late 30s and he was a little over 50. And he said that all of his peers who went straight to university at 18 and were the same age were bored out of their minds now because every day was the same thing. And so they were just repeating the same things. They weren't really growing. Whereas for him, every day was a new experience and he was excited to get up and learn new things and try new things every single day. And that conversation kind of lit a bomb off in my head where it was actually, there are only so many ways you can write a for loop. There are only so many ways you can do that. What happens when those things cease to be as interesting for me? How do I plan for getting to that situation? Because I'm not going to work right up until the point that I die. And in fact, you know, working probably unhealthy hours at that point in my life isn't going to be something I can carry on past a certain age. So I started having those conversations with myself about that time. And so when children came along, it was quite natural to say, well, what's the most important thing to me? Well, my child. Where am I spending my time? Not my child. What do I change to make this a situation where I'm investing time in the things that I think are the most important? Okay, I need to look at whether my career can do that and get myself to a position where I'm able to make that decision.
Good. The rapid fire round isn't as rapid as I thought, but valuable.
I'm not good at yes, no. I'm not good at yes, no questions. In fact, frequently what I do for people who ask me closed questions is I answer yes and no to force them to ask me, what do you mean? And I say, well, in this situation, I'd say yes, but in this situation, I'd say no. And here's how I'd make the decision between them.
So one piece of advice for new leaders.
Is be curious. You have to learn. If you're not going to treat this as a new job for which you're not equipped, you're going to struggle and other people are going to struggle with you.
Then my most beloved outro question. You actually left a hidden feature, an Easter egg in Skyscanner. I just figured it out. It's in the date picker. And with some tricks, like some DOM tricks, you can actually select a date in the past and define a name, and that makes you actually travel physically back in time. And I'm just disclosing that now. We don't have the chance to try out that feature and travel back in time into your past, into the year 1997 when you worked as senior consultant at Netscape. And we now observe yourself for a while. I don't know what you did there as senior consultant. You can let us know. And you now have the chance to whisper something into young Andy's ears. What would it be?
It would be better with people, I think. It's learn about that people are not random meat bags. They operate on a set of principles which you currently don't understand. And the time you invest in understanding those principles will make you a better human being.
Good answer. Thanks a lot, Andy. It was really fun talking to you. Hope to meet you in person at a certain point. And thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Alpha List podcast. If you like this episode, share it with friends. I'm sure they love it too. Make sure to subscribe so you can hear deep insights into technical leadership and technology trends as they become available. Also, please tell us if there is a topic you would like to hear more about or a technical leader whose brain you would like us to pick. Alpha List is all about helping CTOs getting access to the insights they need to make the best decisions for their company. Please send us suggestions to cto@alphalist.com. Send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. After all, the more knowledge we bring to CTOs, the more growth we see in tech. Or, as we say on AlphaList, accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth. See you in the next episode.